It really is such an honor to be here tonight and to be one of the people that is on the stage and with the privilege of moderating this panel of individuals who have really been so committed to addressing the issue of sexual assault long before the Stanford rape case, which, as many of you know, the perpetrator, Brock Turner, was sentenced to, he was convicted of sexually assaulting an unconscious woman and was sentenced to 6 months in jail, a sentence that sparked intense public outrage and a recall effort of the judge who sentenced him, Aaron Persky, and of course one of the individuals on our panel is one of the people who is spearheading that effort. The reaction to this case is something that I think causes us to question the cultural moment we're in right now. We had this very powerful letter that was written by the survivor of the assault that she read aloud in court that I think played a role in intensifying the outrage and the attention on sexual assault. And I think for some, that's a sign of hope that this issue is finally getting the attention it deserves. But at the same time, some are confused by, then what do we make of the sentence, which has been widely viewed as very lenient in this case? If I'm getting my facts right, he faced a maximum sentence of 14 years. I think the DA's office recommended 6, and he ended up with 6 months, and there's a strong chance that he will not end up serving all of that time. And so what I want to talk about tonight with this panel of guests is that tension, is the strategies that they are all pursuing to try to address this issue, because they're different, but they're around the shared goal of trying to reduce the incidence of sexual assault. And I again just want to remind folks, for our listening audience as well, in case this gets aired on the radio, that we're joined by Adam Bink. He's the campaign director of the advocacy and grassroots organizing group Ultraviolet. We're also joined by Michelle Dauber to his right, who's the professor of law and sociology at Stanford University and spearheading the recall campaign. We have Bay Area Congresswoman Jackie Speier with us as well, sitting next to Adam Bink. And of course, next to me is Jay Boyarsky, who is filling in for Jeffrey Rosen. He is the Chief Assistant District Attorney for the Santa Clara County District Attorney's Office. So thank you, all of you, for being here this evening. I want to start by getting a sense of the scope of the issue. There is a very frequently cited statistic by lawmakers and by the news media as well, that 1 in 5 undergraduate women are sexually assaulted. And I want to know, Jackie Speier, if that is an accurate statistic today. It's frequently contested by some who feel like it should be more specific to rape itself as opposed to other forms of sexual assault. But is that still an accurate statistic? I think it is
an accurate statistic. It is 1 in 5 that will be sexually assaulted, or an attempt of sexual assault will be made against them. And there's been a lot of controversy over that particular statistic. George Will did a column that was particularly offensive to some of us, that I think underscores the fact that there are still people, even though that is a very accurate figure, that there are still people that want to deny it.
And I did find that there were a couple of recent surveys by the Association of American Universities and by the Department of Justice that actually ended up validating that statistic. Michelle Dauber, is your understanding that that accurately reflects the situation on college campuses today?
Actually, the number's low, because the actual number should measure senior women only. And in other words, we want to know what are the odds, essentially, that in your 4 years here at Stanford, for example, you would experience some form of sexual violence. And when you look at senior women only, the number is actually 25% or higher. The number at Stanford is actually 43%. 43%
among senior female college women?
43% of senior undergraduate females at Stanford report that during their 4 years with us, they have experienced some form of sexual assault or serious sexual misconduct during their time with us. And that number should be a pants on fire emergency for Stanford and for every other college in America.
So then what is the status, of how colleges are addressing it in America? And I'm asking you specifically, Michelle Dauber, in the sense that you've worked with Stanford, right, in terms of crafting their response to complaints or reports of sexual assault. So where were they and where are they now?
Well, Stanford, like a lot of schools, I think has really struggled in this area to address the issue in an effective way. I think that, you know, they have made progress, but I think there's much, much more to do. And I'll just take the aftermath of the Brock Turner case for an example. If you compare, for example, the way Stanford has dealt with this issue to, for example, the way Harvard has, I think you can see some useful comparisons in addressing fraternities. All the research shows that fraternities are a location of risk for women undergraduates at our colleges and universities. One study showed that every woman who attends one fraternity party per month raises her risk of sexual assault by 38%. So they are a dangerous place in some schools.
Do you know who did that study?
That was the Bureau of Justice Statistics. So what do we do at Stanford after a young woman is brutally sexually assaulted at a party, at a fraternity party, during this party that is a Stanford-sanctioned and sponsored event? We have done, to my knowledge, no real soul-searching inquiry into whether fraternities need further regulation and supervision, whether they need to have private security, for example, during their parties, whether more needs to be done. Harvard has decided not to have fraternities at all and not even to allow single-sex student organizations to thrive within their universities. So I think, you know, there are things that we could be doing that we're not doing that I hope we do in the future.
Well, Adam Bink, Ultraviolet has worked to raise awareness of issues that are affecting folks on campus and specifically to try to get college campuses to change the way that they address sexual assault. You know, one of the things that I was sent was the effort that was made at Dartmouth. Can you talk a little bit about what happened there and what Ultraviolet tried to do?
Well, at Dartmouth, we worked to raise awareness of not only the statistics, as Michelle was describing, but what happens after you go to the fraternity party. You raise your risk of sexual assault, and you also raise your risk of no justice. You raise your risk that people will ask you questions like, what were you wearing? And if you went to a fraternity, how much did you have to drink? Because you must have wanted a drink, and you must have been looking for sex. And so after the fact, after an attempted or completed rape, at a fraternity, women find themselves being faced with doubt and harassment and judgment in ways that men don't often, and in ways that for other crimes, one doesn't experience that. One should experience help and sympathy and justice. And so we work to raise awareness of this and change the culture on campus.
Jackie Spear, is it getting better? I mean, in 2014, we know the Obama administration put out their task force. They tried to address this issue. They tried to put some penalties on universities that did not address sexual assault in the way that they felt was, you know, efficient and effective. What's happened since 2014?
Well, actually, a lot has happened. There is a website that was put up called It's On Us. The Office of Civil Rights has sought more funding. You know, the issue really comes down to, where is the money? That's what drives university conduct here. And the Title IX provides that, and while it's been around for 44 years, not everyone appreciates it as the basis on which we protect more than women in sports. We protect everyone in an educational setting so that no one is discriminated against based on sex. And the result is that the Office of Civil Rights has seen a huge uptick in the number of cases, complaints that have been filed. I would like to give a shout out to the millennials, because this issue's been around, it has been unaddressed, and it's young women dragging mattresses across their graduation stage and founding organizations like Know Your Nine that has really raised everyone's awareness. In the Office of Civil Rights in 1980, there were over, I think, 1,300 staff members handling about 300 cases. I may be off on these numbers a little bit, but what has happened in the interim is that there are three times as many cases that are filed, and it is expected to be handled with one half the staff that existed in 1980. So one of the things that I'm attempting to do is increase the funding for the Office of Civil Rights so that they can do their job. Right now, there are about 265 cases pending in the office for 205 universities, and three of the top five universities in this country have complaints and investigations ongoing right now.
So the Office of Civil Rights is overseeing the way universities are handling the cases, so, or investigating the cases as well?
Yes, they do the investigation.
Okay.
And with the stick is the fact that if you are found to be in violation of Title IX, you lose federal funding. So you lose grant money and you lose all of the student loan money. In the 44 years, it has never been exercised because it is such a big stick. And so one of the things we're trying to do in legislation is creating other fining structures so that in addition to Title IX, we can impose fining penalties.
And I'd actually like to talk with you about your legislation around that. But Jeff Boyarsky,
Jay
Boyarsky, sorry, Jeffrey Rosen is in my head because I was so prepared to have him here. Jay Boyarsky, do you feel like the steps that the universities are taking, that they're equipped to deal with the steps necessary, right, to address a complaint initially before it gets maybe further investigated by the Office of Civil Rights?
Before I answer that question, we've been talking here for 10 or 15 minutes, and I want to recognize the victim in the Brock Turner case and her courageousness and her unbelievable voice. And if it weren't for her amazingness and her courage, I think it's safe to say that none of us would be here on this stage, and all of the fantastic people who are here listening. We owe a debt to the victim in the Brock Turner case, because what she has done is really started a revolution that was long overdue. And just as Congresswoman Speer gave a shout out to the millennials, I think we need to recognize the strength and courage of our victim. And as she has said in her letter, which I'm sure everyone here has read, she is every woman and she is every victim. So let's just remind ourselves why we're here. It's the power of one person who represents many people. So I just wanted to make that point, because for many of us who have been involved in this case, it was a life-changing experience, and I've been a prosecutor fighting for victims of crime for 21 years. And the moment that I was in the courtroom in Palo Alto and I heard the victim read that letter to the judge, it was a life-changing, amazing experience. So, but Mina, to answer your question, I don't know that universities are particularly well-equipped to deal with this problem, but I do know that there seems to be a conflict of interest that's presents itself, which is that universities, even public universities, don't want bad press, and they don't want to be known as the place where they have a sexual assault problem. It's sort of like your local chamber of commerce doesn't like to advertise the crime rate of the city. Universities don't want to become known as a place that's dangerous to students, and that poses, and why is that? It sort of has to do with money, as the congresswoman says, but it has to do with attracting students and protecting one's reputation at the expense of protecting the students that attend the school. And so the people that really want to protect victims and rape and make sure that rape is just not a normal college experience are police officers, prosecutors, victim advocates, and other people that fight for justice in the community. We, all of us, want to partner with the universities, and they're certainly well-intentioned people at these universities, but we shouldn't deny that sometimes there appears to be a conflict of interest between some of these entities and what really needs to be done, which is to raise the profile of this issue, have people come out of the shadows, and say this is absolutely unacceptable.
May I add to
that
point?
Yeah, Adam Bink, go ahead.
One of the campaigns that we launched, and I think that this builds on what he's saying, is the Princeton Review needs to point out which colleges and universities are dangerous when it comes to sexual assault. We launched a campaign to convince the Princeton Review to do this and immediately saw a sea change in how colleges and universities perceive a threat to them almost as it's like an institutional threat. And if I have the right to know about the food and how walkable my campus is and the academics and everything else about it, but I don't have the right to know about my public safety, that's something we have to change. And so I think that we do have to shine a bright spotlight on every college, university, public and private, to show parents and students you have a right to know where you're going and what are the problems there and how we need to fix them.
Did you get a response?
The Princeton Review agreed to modify their online listing and our campaign to change the magazine you can pick up at newsstands also still needs to be changed.
Michelle,
can I jump in here? Which is that I agree that with this, and I agree that transparency is very important. What we really suffer from is a lack of good data. I have been doing this a long time, and one of the things that we need desperately is a single, uniform, mandatory, anonymous climate survey that students at every college and university will take. Right now, the data is not particularly good, it's not transparent, it's not publicly available, and it's impossible to get to. The government needs to step in and conduct this survey and require our colleges and universities to all take the same survey. And quickly, one example that can just tell you everything you need to know about this is Stanford did its own survey. It didn't want to participate in the AAU survey, so it wrote its own survey, and its survey announced to the world that only 1.9% of the students at Stanford experienced sexual assault, in contrast with the 25% that were found to be everywhere else. And it was only through a careful reanalysis of the data that actually I did with a group of students that we were able to get at that 43% number and sort of force Stanford to really acknowledge the severity of the problem. So I think that we desperately need data, it desperately has to be public, and it very much needs to be transparent and uniform.
Well, Congresswoman Jackie Speier, that's part of what your HALT Act is trying to do, right, is trying to mandate that universities do climate surveys. Do you want to talk a little bit about what that act aims to do and what its status
sure.
is right now?
But before doing it, if I could, to Adam's point, I took my college bound daughter to the proverbial campus tour of many institutions. She is now a graduate sitting in the back of the room. So all went well. But the first question, the first question that was asked by parents at every orientation meeting that I attended was, how safe is this campus? And, you know, at the point of talking about blue phones and red phones and, you know, missing the point altogether. So it is the number one concern that parents have, and universities have skirted the issue for a very long time. Now, the HALT Act is something that I've introduced over a course of a number of years. It really came on the heels of the work I did on rape in the military. And the incidence of sexual assault in the military is horrific. It's been going on for a quarter of a century, and we have about 20,000 members of the military who are sexually assaulted every year. Only about 5,000 report, because if they report, they know that they're probably going to lose their career. And of those, 500 are court-martialed and 250 are actually convicted. So on the heels of that, military came to me and said, well, you don't understand. Our numbers aren't any worse than they are on college campuses. And I thought, all right, then we've got a problem there too. And so this legislation has been introduced, and I've worked with a lot of young victim survivors. And it's a travesty to see how their lives have been tormented, how they have been in situations where they can't complete their programs, where in many cases, you know, they're told, well, be a barista for the next semester or two and let the perpetrator graduate. Some of them had stories to tell me that they were never even interviewed by the university. I mean, really serious problems in terms of how universities have been investigating these cases, much like the military, because they want to sweep these cases under the rug. So the HALT Act will require this survey, much like we have now required in the military. It is a very good measure. And to Michelle's point, yes, it has to be uniform and something that we can compare university to university. It also provides for much more information being provided to students about what their rights are, where they can access services. And all of this information has to be in public places and dorm bathrooms and the like. There's additional programming around training, more opportunities for penalties to be imposed short of the Title IX stick, and you know, a number of other refinements that we're going to probably do in the legislation next year.
My understanding is that it would open up a path for students to sue the university as well if they felt like they were mishandling.
Right, a private right of action would be allowed under that particular legislation.
I mean, if you go to,
if
anyone here goes to websites on different college campuses and you were to search their websites for what do I do if I'm a victim of a sexual assault, you would be astonished at the how the information is really lacking. For example, which is why District Attorney Jeff Rosen for years has been working on this issue, and even before the Brock Turner case, essentially called all the presidents of the 9 colleges and universities in Santa Clara County to come forward and have a symposium, which we're going to have on November 18th, so that we can all get on the same page. Because some colleges and universities, if you look at their website, the advice to victims is you may not want to rush forward and call the police if you've been assaulted. The statute of limitations is, in many cases, several years, so there's no rush. Get your bearings straight and take a deep breath, which arguably is well-intentioned, but there's a difference between the viability of a prosecution and it being barred by the statute of limitations. So obviously, if someone has been sexually assaulted, it's critically important that they go to law enforcement and then they can be given a sexual assault response team medical exam and evidence can be gathered. And in the unfortunate event that a victim of sexual assault later decides that they don't want to come to court, which is rare because we provide victim services to victims who come forward who have been sexually assaulted. If they decide they don't want to cooperate, that's a decision that they can make later on. But at that point, we have evidence that has been gathered and the police have gotten involved. So when you ask, well, are colleges and universities, can they deal with this problem? Sometimes they haven't been dealing with it appropriately. And that's why we need to make these changes. And the leadership that the Congresswoman is demonstrating, this is real leadership. And I've been doing this work for 21 years. And I followed the Congresswoman's career in the state legislature, and she tried to get a bill passed to get rid of the statute of limitations for rape and sexual assault of a child, and it got defeated, and it was vetoed. And now it's finally going to the governor's desk. So it takes a long time to achieve results, and I just want to say that Congresswoman Speer has been doing this important work for decades. And as horrible as it was, what happened in the Brock Turner case, and I'm not trying to be Pollyannish about it and put a pretty face on it, very positive things are happening as a result of this case. In much the same way that people didn't used to take drunk driving seriously, and then Mothers Against Drunk Drivers got formed, I think that we're at a turning point in our culture now, and it has to do with the Brock Turner case, where people didn't take rape on college campuses seriously. And finally, rape culture is getting the attention that it deserves, and it's gonna be squashed.
Michelle Dauber, could I ask you quickly to respond to some concerns that have been raised that we could be in danger of an overcorrection if we're not careful about the way that we're, if colleges themselves aren't very good at giving doing a, you know, an effective process, due process to the accused. What's your response to that?
Well, what I would say to that is that, of course, everyone who works in this area, or at least I anyway, we all believe, I believe, that everyone deserves a fair process. No one is well served by an unfair process. The worst thing that can happen to a victim is to have to go through a hearing or a process twice. But let me just go to what was just said about the justice system, because I agree that good things are happening. But I also want to say that, you know, I think as the Baltimore investigation reveals, the justice system has not handled these cases perfectly either. And there are many victims who do not, for whatever reason, choose to bring charges. And they have good reasons in some cases. It is not easy to do what the victim in the Turner case did. It is hard. And I think her letter really shows that. And for those victims, they're still entitled to have their school or college make sure that they have a safe educational environment. We're required by state law and we're required by federal law to provide a safe educational environment for every student, whether they want a criminal prosecution now or ever. So it isn't the case that it's a sort of a magic bullet to say all these cases should go to the police. Not everybody wants to go to the police. The prosecution won't press charges in some cases for failure of proof for whatever reason. And those students are still entitled to get their education. And that is why Title IX is such an important law. The other thing is that, you know, the reason we believe at the recall campaign that it is important to follow through and allow the voters to learn the record of this judge of judicial bias in cases of sexual assault, sexual violence, and violence against women is because of the terrible message that has been sent that has made all women at Stanford and at other college campuses less safe. We have here a victim who did go to the police and who did everything right and went to court and was the so-called perfect victim and still received an absolutely unacceptable result. And if we don't respond to that by letting the voters weigh in, as they are entitled to do under the California Constitution, if we let that go unanswered, then we are going to really suffer the consequences of that and the failure to deter these crimes on our campuses.
And that actually, you've answered part of my next question, which when you bring up the recall, why you think that is a necessary strategy in this particular case and also broadly to address the issue of sexual assault. Is there anything else you wanted to add to that before I ask you to respond to, of course, the fact that it's controversial and there has been a lot of opposition that's been raised to the recall effort as well?
Well, you know, we are
in terms of why you took this route.
Well, we are taking this route because Judge Persky's record clearly demonstrates a pattern of bias in cases of sex crimes and violence against women. Some of these cases have come forward. Some of them are still continuing to come forward. But we have done a very thorough investigation, and in case after case, it's just become clear that he treats these offenders much more leniently than he should, much more leniently than other judges, as the child pornography information that came out earlier this week shows, where every other judge in Santa Clara County that we could find sentenced child pornography first-time offenders to 6 months, and Judge Persky sentenced the offender who came before him to only 4 days. So we feel there's a pattern of bias, and we think that sort of at the bottom of it is that he doesn't take these crimes seriously, doesn't perceive the harm, doesn't really understand that these are serious felonies, not minor misdemeanors. And furthermore, we believe that this is a voting issue. In California, judges are elected. They're not appointed. They're not vetted the way Article III judges are in the federal system. And at the end of the day, it is up to the voters. And we're really confident that when voters see his record and are able to judge for themselves, when all the facts are on the table, they will choose another candidate.
And Adam Bink, this is a campaign that Ultraviolet has very much signed on to and supports, correct? The recall.
We've actually signed on to a different path to, I think, what would be the same outcome. Legally, Ultraviolet does not get involved in elections. What we've campaigned to do is ask the California Commission on Judicial Performance to take action in removing Judge Persky from the bench. What Michelle had mentioned, and I think is correct in both paths, is that if you look at the Judicial Code of Ethics, which I have right here, the appearance of bias toward a particular class, a judge shall perform judicial duties without bias or prejudice, including not but not limited to bias or prejudice based on race, sex, gender, age, status, socioeconomic status, well, we have a privileged white male Stanford athlete who stood with another privileged white male Stanford athlete, which I think is not a surprise to many people here. And what that shows us, in addition to the cases that Michelle mentioned, standing with other individuals after their sex crimes is a perception of bias that is in fact real. And that's why Judge Percy needs to go and the California Commission on Judicial Performance has to act.
Well, Jay Boyarsky, Jeffrey Rosen has gone on record saying that he doesn't support the recall effort necessarily. Why not? Why isn't it a good idea?
He has said that at this time he does not necessarily support the recall. And what our position and what the district attorney's position is can best be summed up by the fact that there are well over 1,000 judges in California, and that while the sentence and the decision of Judge Persky was deplorable and just really out of line, what we're trying to do is change the law so that all the other 1,000-plus judges would not be able to screw up the same way that Judge Persky screwed up. And so, Mina, we've introduced a piece of legislation in the legislature. It's AB 2888, which I'm proud to say just passed out of the state Senate unanimously. It's going back to the assembly floor, and then it will be on Governor Brown's desk. And basically what this law says is that while judges are independent and they should have discretion in how they sentence a rapist, the discretion should be limited to how long they're going to go to state prison, not that they should be allowed to avoid prison.
So it would mandate prison sentences for those who have been convicted of raping an unconscious victim.
It shouldn't matter whether a rapist uses a knife or uses alcohol. Someone who forcibly rapes a college student should not necessarily be treated any worse than the college student who just lies in wait, waiting for alcohol or drugs to take effect, and then acts as a predator on that victim. So AB 2888 would mandate a prison sentence for everyone that commits a rape in the state of California.
So I'm assuming then that the status now, since it passed out of the Senate and was introduced in the Assembly, that it will go to a floor vote and then to the governor's desk. Any indication if Governor Brown is interested in signing it?
He's notoriously tight-lipped about these sorts of things. And I, sitting with Congresswoman Speer, I wouldn't talk. I'm no expert on how the legislature works, but we're very optimistic that the governor will sign this much-needed
reform bill. Legislation has raised its own controversies just in terms of mandatory sentencing. But before we get into that, I do want to ask Michelle Dauber, just so that we can complete this conversation around the recall, and I'm sure the audience members will have questions around that as well. But, you know, what is your reaction? There was a Merck article where several prominent, you know, law professors signed it. I'm sure you're familiar with this letter that basically laid out their arguments for why it would not be a good idea to recall this judge, including the fact that it would undermine their independence, you know, if they're concerned about whether or not they could be ousted by somebody who didn't like the way that they sentenced a particular convicted felon, I guess, in the case of Brock Turner, but that it sort of undermines their independence and their ability to do what they feel is right, separate from public opinion. What's your response to that?
I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about judicial bias, right? Independence is a privilege, right? And it comes with the understanding that you will act without bias. And so bias itself has an extremely corrosive effect on the legitimacy of the system and on the willingness of rape victims and domestic violence victims, which also seems to be a particular problem for this judge, to come forward and seek the help of the criminal justice system. It also, I mean, there's a lot of empirical research that shows that when people do not have access to an unbiased decision maker, they lose faith in the system generally, in the whole legal system. It's essential to the rule of law. Every person is entitled to an unbiased decision maker. And right now, we believe that the people coming before Judge Persky, both defendants, as I think the sentencing of a defendant of color shows when contrasted with Mr. Turner, and victims deserve an unbiased decision maker. And just to wrap that up, I just want to say that that the idea that all judges are suddenly going to become scared if we win this recall, I find, I think that, you know, it sort of has a low opinion of judges contained within it, right? That all these judges are so morally abased that they're just suddenly going to start throwing people in jail, even when they don't think it's the right thing to do because they are afraid. And I have more confidence in the other 999 judges in the state of California than that. I think that the way to deal with a bad judge who is elected is to unelect that judge. And so I'm not worried. Also, recalls are hard. Recalls are very difficult. They're expensive, they're costly, they're time consuming. We're going to raise $1 million.
What's the status
for this?
Of your recall?
So we are doing great. We have been endorsed by many members of Congress and other elected officials around the state.
Including Congresswoman Speier? Congresswoman Speier?
Well, I have had many conversations with Michelle about this, and
I didn't mean for her to put you on the spot, by the way. I did not give her that question at all, and you can pass if you want.
Yes,
I think it's a very important question, and I haven't taken a position on the recall. I have indicated that I really want to see him forced to step down. To Michelle's point, it's a very costly procedure. It's going to require the electorate to stay focused on this issue for another year and 3 or 4 months. And I think the public pressure to ask him to step down could be just as effective and much less costly in the process. So,
but you believe he should?
I believe he should. I think there's a very strong case to show that.
And let me just say that I welcome the opportunity to keep this issue in the public eye for the next year. From my perspective, this is an opportunity because we're going to communicate with voters in Santa Clara County. And by the way, 67% of Santa Clara County voters support the recall. And that is an independent poll not conducted by the campaign. And it was before they even knew about the child pornography defendant who got a completely unreasonably lenient sentence, much less than any other judge in the county was giving out for the exact same crime. And he had a screensaver of an infant being raped on his iPad when he was arrested by the police. So that was before they knew about him. So I'm pretty confident.
Someone argued that would show some level of consistency, I guess, on Persky's part. But I guess since I asked you about the recall, Congresswoman Speier, can I ask you what your thoughts are on, you know, D.A. Rosen's proposal to basically require prison time for those convicted of sexual assault in the state. So it would essentially be a mandatory sentence.
I'd like to really look at the bill
Before you respond.
Before I respond.
That's good. Good.
But I will say that, and something you said earlier has me concerned. The question that there would be an overcorrection is preposterous.
Because
it is a violent felony to commit rape. Just the only crime more egregious than rape is murder. And we never talk about an overcorrection in a murder case, but all of a sudden, because we're talking about rape, we're talking about potentially an overcorrection. What we also have to keep in mind is that so few of these cases actually come to the district attorney, are taken up by the district attorney, and pursued. And when you think of all of the violence that goes on, that destroys people's lives, men and women, because 6% of rape victims or sexual assault victims are men, that, you know, we're losing sight of what we have to do. We have got to reform the system so that people are safe in a college campus to be able to pursue their educational opportunities.
I think you're touching on something, which is, why is that, right? That is what ends up emerging in terms of opposition arguments, right? This concern about due process and overcorrection. Where do you think we are in terms of, you know, our cultural moment related to sexual assault and our understanding of it as a...
I don't think we're as enlightened as we think we are. Probably people in this room are more so, but I do think that, you know, when I served in the state legislature, I was always, and this is, you know, going back many years now, because I've been out of the legislature for 10 years and I served there for 18, but it was a jockocracy. And I say
jockocracy
because you know, whenever there was a particular sporting event going on, all of a sudden we were canceling session. And it didn't dawn on me at first what was really going on. And so, you know, we have to look at the fact that the majority of those who serve are men. So when you look at what happened with divorce laws and when it went from fault to no fault, it had a lot to do at the time with a lot of members of the state legislature who wanted to get divorced. So there is, you know, I think we are not as evolved and as enlightened as we need to be as we address this issue.
And for people listening, 80% of the audience here today is made up of women. And when I was working with Senator Ahlquist and then Senator Speer to get rid of the statute of limitations for rape, it was Democrats, unfortunately, that were killing those bills. I speak as a lifelong Democrat, but it was female Democrats that were always pushing those bills. And it was Republicans of both genders that were favoring these bills to get rid of the statute of limitations. And so I don't think we're as enlightened as we are. However, I think we're moving in the right direction. And we can just point to one thing, which is this bill, Senator Leyva's bill. She's a senator from Riverside. She got her bill to repeal the statute of limitations for raping a child. She got it through both houses of the Assembly and the Senate. It's going to go to Governor Brown's desk. And so that's one very positive thing that's happening.
Adam Bink, you've been wanting to get in here.
Culturally, so when I entered college, which was 02, I graduated in 06, I was asked to do a series of things. Don't drink, don't use drugs, don't skip class, don't drink and drive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And nowhere in there was anything about consent and sexual assault. And it's still not. And we know this because our members tell us so. And all the blue light phones and all the things you can put in a drink to see if a date rape drug has been slipped in there, and all the counselors you can see, do not solve this problem, because it's like treating polio with drugs and never a vaccine. It has to start culturally to end rape by teaching people to not rape, teaching people to obtain consent and measures to require this.
A moment, just because I do need to let our audience know that if you would like to ask a question, now's the time to get into the queue, because in 5 minutes, we'll be taking your questions for the panelists. And again, it's this far aisle over here where Marissa is standing. And I'm told to please remind you to ask single one-part questions that are actually questions. Sorry, go ahead.
No, please.
Finish your thought.
The second point I wanted to make is the reporting rate. We've talked about the rate of assault, attempted or completed rape. The reporting rate, I believe, is barely double digits, barely 12%. And that was before Judge Persky stood with Turner, meaning people today look at whether to report or not and say, well, what's going to be done? The police will ask, you know, do you have a boyfriend? Because they want to assume you just cheated, and that's why you're, you know, crying wolf. They'll ask about your clothing, your drinking, all of that. The prosecutor may not take action. The police may not recommend even prosecution. And then if you do make it all the way to someone like Judge Persky, there'll be no justice. So that's something that has to change as well, to inspire, as Michelle said, faith and confidence in our judicial system that something will be done concerning the crime that is, as the Congresswoman said, just a step below murder.
Well, in the last few minutes before we go to questions, I do want to at least try to address where we have made progress. Like, what are examples of where you are seeing an impact based on your advocacy, your, you know, legal, educational, legislative efforts, right? I mean, can you point to something that keeps you motivated? Because as Jay Boyarsky was saying, we're on the right track. What are the things that make you feel this way, Michelle Dauber?
Well, I think that I agree with what Jay said. And actually, I want to recognize Ale Kianersi, I hope I said that right, who was the prosecutor in the Brock Turner case and got a conviction. And the fact that he was convicted I think that the charges were brought, that there was a conviction, is a sign of progress in a sense. Although, on the other hand, I mean, we had DNA, we had eyewitnesses, you know, it wasn't, you know, there was certainly a time when that wouldn't have happened. Since that happened, the outcry around this, that really encourages me. I agree with Jay. I don't think it's all the victim in this case. I've known the victim in this case since she was a little girl. I think she is remarkable. I think she's important. I think she's a great new voice. But, you know, there have been a lot of survivors and a lot of people building this movement. There was the Hunting Ground film. I think the fact that this issue has really captivated in many ways and crystallized this is because millennial women are refusing to accept business as usual. And one of the things that I'm the most excited about actually is the Recall Campaign's partnership with Girl Cult, the leader of which is here. And I think that, you know, this is an incredibly important fact that young women, first of all, young women are only 20% of political donors. They're not as engaged politically, and women, period, of any age, right, are not as engaged politically, at least at the money side and at running for office. And this campaign has grabbed them, and they want to help, and they want to donate, and they want to participate in electoral politics, which is why I said to Representative Speer, hey, I'm okay with running this campaign for a year. I think this is great. It's a great opportunity to capture that and engage with it.
Well, let's take questions from the audience, and we'll try to fit in as many as possible. So as they've requested, if you could make your questions as tight as you can.
Okay. First, a couple of comments, short.
break the rules.
Right out of the gate.
Just break the rules.
47 years ago, I was raped on the campus of the University of Massachusetts.
I'm so sorry.
It is saddening, shocking, and appalling that we're still talking about this as a grassroots issue. One of the ways I dealt with being raped was to become a community activist to help to support consciousness raising on college campuses. I continue to be involved in supporting women's issues and empowering women through my community involvement here in San Francisco in leadership positions. One of my concerns is that there are rape kits sitting in evidence lockers in communities across the country that are a year old at least. What's being done to move forward on addressing the cases that are still waiting to be prosecuted?
Jay Boyarsky.
I want to really underscore that the only way that we end up with a so-called rape kit, which is the evidence that's gathered, the only way we ever get that is because a victim has the courage to call the police and come forward. So I have enormous respect for victims and whether they decide to pursue the process down the line. Please, if there's one takeaway from tonight, it should not be, maybe you should report it, maybe you shouldn't. Yes, we all know it's going to be an arduous, difficult process if you're raped and then to go through the system, but please call the police. There's support for you out there, and that's how we can then get a rape kit that can then be tested.
But what is the situation in Santa Clara? I mean, is there a significant, is there a backlog of
kits? We have no untested rape kits in Santa Clara County, I'm very proud to say, and we're the largest prosecution office in Northern California.
This is not an issue that we should still be talking about. The technology is there now. It is not expensive to do the analysis of rape kits. The fact that universities don't have rape kits in their clinics is astonishing and disgusting to me. When you're raped on a college campus like Stanford, you've got to go 30 miles to Valley Medical.
Valley Med, yeah.
In order to get tested with a rape kit. So the technology is there. The cost has come way down. And the fact that throughout this country, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of these rape kits that have never been tested is really shameful. The federal government through Congress has done little things like create incentives for states and local jurisdictions to test these rape kits, but it's very, very little. And we should just demand it. It's one of those situations where
we should all get rid of the statute of limitations for rape and child molest so that when we get this evidence tested, even if it's 10 or 15 or 20 years down
DNA
the line,
DNA is DNA.
DNA is DNA.
Yeah. Next question.
So my question is primarily for Professor Dauber. I appreciate your call for a universal anonymous survey of college students. I'm a co-founder of Annie Cannons, which is a 501c3 teaching human trafficking survivors to code, and we have built that already. And I know we're not the only people in this room who are trying to reach sexual assault survivors and bring them together to effect real change. I'm wondering how we can leverage, how the other people in this room can leverage the networks that you've built through your research and your work to get the word out about solutions that are community-based and aggregation-based.
I think that's great, and I think those tools are good, and I think that, you know, there are obviously ways to reach out to people like me, and I'm happy to talk to you after this session and take your card and be back in touch. But I don't want to take the onus off the university itself. I think that, you know, what's missing in our system is accountability up and down the line. Accountability at the level of the judge, accountability at the level of Brock Turner, accountability at the level of Stanford University. I think that the schools have to be accountable, the perpetrators have to be accountable, the police and prosecutors, when they fall down, not that anybody in this room has, should be held accountable, and the judges are not above the law either. So I'm focused on holding the schools accountable for doing those surveys at this point. I think that's the right thing to do, and I support the HALT bill.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you all so much for your work on this issue. So I graduated from college last year, and I was actually a sorority president. So I watched this on the ground as it was happening and had a lot of friends and sisters who I was basically liable and accountable for and had to go through a lot of difficult processes. So my question is also for Michelle. You briefly mentioned the Harvard initiative to get rid of single-sex organizations. And for me personally, my sorority in the Panhellenic community on campus was where the drive to bring awareness to this issue started. So to what extent do you think policies like that that restrict, in some people's opinion, freedom of association, how much is that missing the point? I just wanted to kind of get your opinion on that. Because in my opinion, it really should be education from the fraternities. And we actually brought sorority women into fraternities to do that education. So do you see that there's a risk of those policies coming down that restrict freedom as kind of like a backlash to these awful things that are going on? What's your opinion of that?
Well, what I think is there's a safety question. And there between, you know, what we're doing now and what could be done, there's a range of things that could be making these situations safer. For example, we could require the fraternities at Stanford to have private security officers who are not a fraternity brother who promises to patrol the grounds. We could have video cameras that are outside of the premises, like in dark places by dumpsters where we know stuff like this could happen. I mean, there's just a range of things we could do from landscape architecture up to private security. What we're doing now isn't working. It's not safe. Okay, and the name of the game is campus safety. Harvard took a look at its situation and decided that these organizations, and I understand all the arguments that you have and all your feelings, and I work with a lot of sororities at Stanford who, you know, feel similarly. At the end of the day, the name of the game is campus safety. We have an obligation under state and federal law to keep our students safe. If we have situations on campus that cannot be made safe, then we have an obligation both morally and legally to make them safe. And right now, what we haven't done is say, okay, we need to take a step back and look at this situation. We had a terrible thing happen in a fraternity. And by the way, isn't the only thing that's happened at a fraternity in the area of sexual assault at Stanford, okay? And look at that and say, what do we need to do? We need to take this seriously. And that's what I haven't seen.
Michelle Dauber, I'm curious, what proportion of men report sexual assault or either at Stanford or nationwide, do you know?
It's about 6% of men.
Nationwide.
Broadly, and at Stanford.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to imply, and it's actually a higher proportion of transgender students than it is even of cisgender women. So I don't mean to imply that this is a problem limited to women. Representative Spear said that earlier, and that's absolutely true. Also, gay, lesbian, bisexual women, LGBT women are at the highest risk. We need to be intersectional in our approach to feminism. We need to be intersectional in our approach to sexual assault. We need to understand who survivors are and support them no matter who they are and where they are.
Next Hello. Question.
Hello. I'd like to thank you all for coming here and providing your points of view. Really appreciate it and thought they were very insightful. I attend UC Berkeley, a school that has only 2 to 3 full-time workers on the Office of Prevention of Harassment and Discrimination and one independent hearing officer who oversees the adjudication of cases of sexual assault and sexual violence. So I was wondering if there's any process or oversight into seeing if policies that the university implements to acquire funding or be compliant with guidelines to get funding are actually effective.
So the Office of Civil Rights in the Department of Education has this responsibility, and they will send out what they call Dear Colleague letters, and institutions throughout the country that receive federal funds have to comply with that. So the audits and the investigations that are going on now in the 205 universities across this country are looking at precisely what you're asking about. Is there serious investigations being done? How are they being conducted? Is the victim being interviewed? What steps are taken after there is a finalization of their reports? Those are the kinds of things that the Office of Civil Rights is required to do. Now, I talked earlier about the number of cases. The number of cases has just grown dramatically. The number of staff has dropped way down. Last year in the budget, there was an additional $7 million that was provided to the Office of Civil Rights. They are hoping this year that we will add $30 million. Now, $30 million will give them 560 employees, full-time equivalents. Back in 1980, when they had a third as many cases, they had over 1,100 employees. So we still have a long way to go, and it's going to take resources to do it.
Thank you.
And we have time for two more questions.
Good evening. Thanks for being here. Just a little high. So my question's a little bit more philosophical and abstract, so I'll contextualize it really quickly. I just graduated from Cal. Thank you. And the last 2 to 3 years of my time there were spent working very closely with administrators on this issue and how to address it. And a common theme I saw in Berkeley and also at the UC system was a rush to solve this, which often led to pretty shoddy solutions. And an example was actually mandatory sentencing, which proved to be a deterrent for a lot of survivors to report. And part of that was a lot of pressure that the UC system and Cal felt actually from OCR to have investigations completed in 60 days, which makes sense on one hand because we want to get these solved quickly. We want to make sure that justice is swift. But oftentimes didn't account for the needs of survivors who might not be able to immediately go to police or who might need that half a year to deflate and understand what happened to them before they can talk to someone. So my abstract philosophical question is just what thoughts you might have on the issue of balance between a need for time and thought about how to address these cases, but at the same time, a need for swift solutions and swift progress.
I mean, I would disagree that that's been the problem at Cal. I think the problem, I just would disagree respectfully with you that that was the problem at Cal. And certainly the need to complete an investigation within 60 days has nothing to do with how long it takes the survivor to come forward. It's from the time she reports, not from the time the incident occurs. And Cal did not move to a system of mandatory sentencing. It has sentencing ranges for sanctions. So I'm not, I just would disagree with what has happened at Cal. And I think that if you talk to many of the women who have experienced sexual harassment, sexual assault at Cal, they would see that somewhat differently. So I don't think there's been a rush. We've been dealing with this issue for 40 years. I don't think that there's been a blind rush for this to get justice for sexual assault survivors in the college context.
Sorry, I meant like a rush in determining processes and procedures. There was a lot of like, we need to get a solution and a procedure in place by this date. And that's, so having been in conversations with other admin across the system, it was a lot of how do we make this process done by this date instead of how do we listen to the voices in the room.
Right, but they had already delayed for 5 years before that happened.
Well, I think the other thing that's important to point out here is that many of these cases drag on for years in investigations, and students are graduating before they ever find out whether or not there's been a resolution in their case. So, I mean, I think that you can determine in a 2 months, 3 months, I mean, in a period of time that allows both parties to be able to, you know, move on with their lives. One of the big problems we have, though, is that when there is a determination made that there was, in fact, a sexual offense, let's say it does not go to the DA, it's just determined at the college campus, and that particular student is terminated, expelled, suspended, nothing follows them. Now, if they had cheated on a test, it would go down on their transcript, but nothing goes down on their transcript that they had sexually assaulted another student. So they go on to another campus, and, you know, as we have found out in many studies, predators offend and reoffend six times before they're ever caught. So again, it comes back to this whole issue of safety for all students on campus.
Do we still have time for that one last question?
Thank you. Hi, thanks for being here. I have one comment really quick and a question. The comment being, no, really, really quickly, I think the intersectional feminism was really important because I feel that what was mentioned about the Brock Turner's victim being the reason why we're talking about these things was almost like diminishing all the other victims of other ethnicities, races that have been struggling with this for years and maybe have not been heard because of that same thing. And this was also a student from Stanford. So there's also like a respect that comes from that. Now the question, Commonwealth Funding Forum had a talk about recidivism and how it's like a very big issue. And I think we definitely don't need more young males in jails. And I don't want to excuse any perpetrators and I don't want to avoid punishment. But I think that this might not be the best solution. Maybe it's the best solution in hand. But I would like to know if you have thought about other alternatives.
Is this for Jay Boyarsky broadly?
Yeah.
Well, because one of the things I would like to, if it's okay, you know, the state's been moving away, right, from mandatory minimums in part because of the prison overcrowding issue and also because their folks are very concerned that it disproportionately affects people of color, low-income people.
The answer to the question, and Mina, I think the answer to your question is that prison beds cost a lot of money, and we have an over-incarceration problem, and therefore what we need to do is make sure that the appropriate people are going to prison. But I have to tell you, rapists should go to prison. And for years and years and years, especially when they're people of privilege or the attack takes place on a campus, we have not been taking the cases seriously, and judges haven't been sentencing people appropriately. And so let's all take a deep breath, and I want you to understand some data, which is that 6 years ago, there were 170,000 Californians in prison. Way too many. Today, there are about 125,000 people in state prison, and the crime rate has not appreciably increased. The data is varied on that point. So let's just take a deep breath and realize that the trend line in terms of who we're incarcerating is moving in the right direction. The bill that Jeff Rosen is sponsoring and that's working its way through the legislature is predicted to possibly lead to 100 more people going to prison per year. And I would submit to you that that would be the appropriate, those candidates, those people who are convicted of those crimes, that's who we want in state prison.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there because I'm being told there is an informal tradition where all speakers are asked this question. What is your 60-second idea to change the world? And I will start with you, Michelle Dauber.
Oh, man, I wanted to go second. I think that the most important thing that we can expect from our political system is accountability. And if I could change one thing about the world, it would be that we would hold people accountable at all levels, like I said. And I do want to say in my 10 seconds that I have left, that I think that there are some assumptions about the victim of Brock Turner, about her race and ethnicity, that people really should check those assumptions, because no one knows that information. And I think because she was a Stanford attack, people are making assumptions, and they shouldn't do that. She said, "I am every woman," and I think that that's important to remember. So I just wanted to correct, you know, that assumption that I think is unfair.
I'm going to divide into three 20-second ideas. there's so many to change. Yeah. We have a lot of work to do. One, I think parents, when you talk about the birds and the bees, should talk about consent and how to obtain it. And so should colleges and universities when they enter. Second idea is I think the Princeton Review needs to shine some spotlights and some sunlight on colleges, and I hope everyone will sign a petition to do that. Eventually, the dollars is what matters to these colleges, and when parents and students pull them, we will start to see change. And my last idea is, and I have to thank Jay for this, is that I hope people will take the letter that the survivor, the woman who survived Brock Turner, read in the courtroom, and talk about it with five people, you know. Not send it or share it on Facebook, but actually talk about it, ask people to read it, and then discuss it. Because I think at least one of those people you'll find has problematic views, misperceptions of rape, and eventually we change people's views one at a time.
All right. Congresswoman Jackie Spear.
I'd like to say at the outset that things are changing. I hosted a special hour on the House floor, and we read the victim's statement, the first time in the history of the Congress that that took place. There were Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals, men and women, who came to the House floor to participate in that experience and who were awakened by the issue. I guess the one way that I would like to change the world is to do what we can to reduce terrorism and wars that exist virtually everywhere on the planet. And I think the best way to do that is to educate young girls.
Well, I think we should just elect more women.
For that too.
Well,
we can keep electing Congresswoman Spear, and we should elect more women when it comes to who we vote for president in November. So, but you wanted a realistic answer.
That's
my answer. But the answer, you gave me a little heads up. You gave the panelists a heads up, and I was thinking, well, what would change the world, and what's the 60-second answer? So I think it's to mandate empathy. Mandate empathy. I know it sounds like Senator Vasconcelos to mandate self-esteem, but mandate empathy. Teach people to have empathy. I'm not talking about the other. I'm talking about ourselves. Let's have empathy for others. I think that would change the world.
Well, Jay Boyarsky, Chief Assistant District Attorney for Santa Clara County, Bay Area Congresswoman Jackie Spear, Ultraviolet's Adam Bink, and Michelle Dauber, Stanford Law Professor, thank you all for coming here to share your insights and experiences with all of this, and I hope that the conversation continues after this. But a big round of applause for our panelists.
All of you. Thank you for coming.